If this telecast does not prove interesting, it will be wholly my fault, because the theme itself is, namely the life of Abraham Lincoln. One day the President and Mrs. Lincoln went out for a ride. It was a spring afternoon. It turned into New Jersey Avenue from the White House. And as they did, Mrs. Lincoln said to him, she said, "You almost startle me with your cheerfulness." He said, "Mary, this is the happiest day of my life." There are some who think Lincoln was melancholy. Let's find out what he meant by happiness. No character is ever born great. Character becomes great. Some people's lives are flat and dull. And others have a tension and a pull. There are opposites in them, like the positive and negative poles of electricity. Moses, for example, was not always a meek man. He once killed an Egyptian. He had to become meek. John the Baptist was not always a loving man. He once asked the Lord to rain down fire from heaven upon the Samaritans. And so there was some great tension in Lincoln. And he became great because he was able to reconcile those opposites. Now, what were they? They were adversity and joy. And the two are not as opposed as it would seem. And it took a lifetime to reconcile them. First of all, adversity. He had to pay the penalty of success even as a young man. Someone has said that jealousy is the tribute which mediocrity pays to genius. They said that his simplicity was a pose, that he cultivated the manner of honesty, but that he really was not. He was slandered, for example, by his political opponent, Cartwright, who called him an atheist, which he was not. And Lincoln asked his friends, he said, "Do not answer a charge. As silly as that." Many of his confreres called him the Illinois gorilla, the original baboon. Samuel B. Morse, who invented the telegraph, said that he was an illiterate without any brains. Congress at one time thought of impeaching him. He had to go before Congress once in order to defend his wife against the charge of being a spy. And after he gave the Gettysburg Address, a Chicago paper said, "The blood of every American will tingle with shame on reading the silly, flat, dishwatery utterances of one who has to be pointed out to intelligent foreigners as President of the United States." And then there were other adversities besides slander, great sorrow. When he was a young man, he fell in love with Ann Rutledge. She was only 18. She was in love, at least for a time, with a young man from the East who failed to correspond. Then Lincoln met her. She was beautiful, as fresh as springtime. He asked her to marry him. They were engaged. She was taken ill, seriously. Lincoln was the only one who was allowed at her bedside. When she died, Lincoln said, "I cannot bear the thought of rain falling on her." And he used to go out and walk through the woods near the grave, muttering strange sounds, trying to recover a belief in immortality because he had read some of Voltaire and Volney. He said one day to a friend, pointing to the grave of Anne Rutledge, "My heart is buried there." And yet, with all of that adversity, on the other side, there was something else. There was a joy. A superficial joy and a profound joy. Now, when we speak of joy, let it be understood that joy is not the same as pleasure. Pleasure belongs to the body, joy belongs to the mind. Pleasure changes with circumstances. For example, we are enjoying ourselves in one place or one condition and not in another. Joy, however, is rather constant. Pleasure changes with the years. We do not have the same kind of pleasures when we're old as when we're young. But joy remains always the same. Now, Lincoln had a joy, not a gaiety. It was superficial and profound. Superficial, first of all, and that manifested itself in the love of stories. I think that the incidents that he very often recounted were just a kind of a surface manifestation of something that was really very, very happy down deep in the inside, particularly as adversity increased. One day, Mrs. Lincoln came up to the room they left the White House reception. One of the boys was sick. She had a big, long train on her dress, low neck dress. Lincoln looked at her and said, "Cat has a long tail tonight, dear. Might help if some of the tail were cut off and wrapped around the head." When he was debating Douglas said, "My opponent has been a failure at everything. He was a failure behind a grocery store. He was a failure even in the forest. He was a failure even behind a bar because he sold drinks." And Lincoln said, "Yes, Douglas, and you were on the other side and not a failure in drinking them either." At one time, someone said to him, "Mr. Lincoln, we've never heard you swear or blaspheme. Why is that?" Well, he said, "There was never any need of swearing as long as I had Stanton in the cabinet." Two women, it said, were discussing the relative merits of Jefferson and Lincoln. And one woman said, "You know, Jefferson was a praying man." And the other one, defending the president, said, "But Lincoln is a praying man." "Yes," she said, "I know, but the good Lord can never tell whether or not he's joking." Lincoln said that he never invented a story, that he did not have a wit. He said he was just a retailer of stories. And they got him out of many, many jams and difficulties. But all these things were superficial. Sometimes they illustrated even a domestic policy. He told about a red-haired mother who had 12 children. And he said that she would spank them and whip them and so forth, but she said to her neighbors, "You stay out of this. This is my quarrel, and we settle everything in this house." And Lincoln said, "We settle everything in the United States, and we want no one interfering in our business." But then came another kind of joy. It was the joy that comes from a good conscience, from honesty, humility, and above all, a great vocation. First of all, honest. Well, of course, everyone knows him. Honest Abe. The judges of the Supreme Court of Illinois said he never knew Lincoln to practice deception. On one occasion, his political opponent, or rather his opposing lawyer in a trial, said to the jury, "They call him Honest Abe. He's not honest. He's just clever. He wears a mask. He's an actor. Doesn't believe what he says." And Lincoln said, "You have known me for many years. Is that true?" And the lawyer bounded to his feet and said, "No, it's a lie. And I take it back." One day he said to a client, he said, "From the point of view of law, you have a case. From the point of view of equity and justice, you have none." And he said, "You know, if I took your case and I went before a jury, my conscience couldn't be in it. And I would be saying to myself all the time that I was talking, 'Abraham Lincoln, you're a liar.'" And he said, "You know, I might even say it out loud." He was associated with another lawyer who charged the client $1,000. And Lincoln said to the client, "You've been overcharged. I will charge you nothing." He would never take a case which his own conscience could not defend. And then, in addition to that deep-seated honesty, was a humility. Do you ever notice today how often people will say, contradict themselves, and say, "Well, I'm very proud, and I say it in all humility." I've heard dozens of people receiving awards say that. Lincoln would never accept an award or an honorary chairmanship or anything that did not have some work behind it. And as regards his own conscience and his own humility, say he never cared where he slept, put down in the basement, put up in the garret. He hardly ever knew what he ate. When it was first proposed to him that he become candidate for president, he said, "I'm not worthy to be a president of the United States." Had to be prevailed upon. He said his education was defective. One day a lawyer quoted Latin and said, "You understand what that means, Mr. Lincoln?" He said, "If you're talking Latin, you'll have to ask someone else." Lincoln used to chop his own wood, and even in the White House. Shined his own shoes, and someone saw him one day shining his shoes in the White House and said, "Mr. President, you shining your own shoes?" Lincoln said, "Who else?" And one day, or not one day, but on many occasions, he used to annoy Mrs. Lincoln considerably because he would always open the front door for the visitors. And one day Mrs. Lincoln reprimanded him. She said there was someone there to do that. And the lady who was going out said to Mrs. Lincoln, "Mary," she said, "if I had a husband like that, I wouldn't care what he did." The humility was real and genuine. And as the years went on, he began to see more and more that he owed everything to a power above him. And then allied with that was a sense of a vocation, which he received very early in life, and which never seemed to leave him. He went down the Mississippi as a young man, got off from New Orleans, walked around the French Quarter, Spanish Quarter, and then came to a slave market. He went in with John Hanks. There was the auctioneer standing on a cracker box. All about the room were slaves, stripped to the waist. Prospective buyers were going around, opening their mouths, looking at their teeth, judging them like they might judge a horse. Others forced the slaves to run around the room, see if they had good wind, if they were strong enough for slave labor. And others turned lecherous eyes on the women they bought. Lincoln saw husbands and wives being separated and children being torn from mothers. And he could stand it no longer. And he turned to John Hanks and he said, "Someday I'm going to hit that institution, and I'm going to hit it hard, by the eternal God." Backwoodsman. Illiterate. Talking about an institution that went back to 1437 when a Portuguese sold 10 slaves to someone in Portugal. And he, without any education, any background, was going to hit this institution. By a man who has a vocation like that is happy on the inside. And so the two, joy and adversity, went on through his life. And some biographers will take the joy and make him out to be a humorist, and others will take the adversity and make him out to be melancholic. No, if you see the depth of character, you see the two fusing, because the two are not inseparable. The two can coexist. It's well to remember, for example, that the only night that our blessed Lord ever sang was the night that he went out to his death. And the greatest discourse that he ever gave on joy, and it was the only time he ever spoke on joy, was the night that he went out to die. Paul and Silas sang in prison. There's such a thing as having joy before one, therefore being able to bear any kind of adversity. And that's the making of a great character. Any man who's been through any kind of suffering and borne up under it, has seen it come from the hand of God, he has a joy on the inside that no one can take away from him. And as time went on, it was joy that came out of this adversity and this vocation. So he had a presentiment of death, certainly. He did. He dreamed about it. He dreamt about it one night in Springfield in 1860. He was on a couch. He was looking at a mirror in the far end of the room. And he saw two faces. His own. First one, clear, lifelike. The second, dull and ghastly. He got up from his couch and walked up before the mirror. And two images vanished. Came back again to his couch and looked. And there was the clear one, and there was the dull one. He went to Mrs. Lincoln and he said, "What does it mean?" She said, "I think it means that you will finish your first term, but you will die before the second." And then, 1865, one night he was very quiet. Mrs. Lincoln said to him, "You seem troubled." "Yes." "That I've been troubled about a dream." And he said, "What is strange is that in the morning when I woke up, I took up the Bible and I turned it over. And every page that I turned was a page about a dream or a vision, beginning with the vision of Jacob and the angels ascending and descending the ladder." And she said, "What was the dream?" He said, "I went to bed rather sad. I was worried about reports from the front. And I fell asleep, and I was not asleep very long, when in my dream I got up and I went downstairs to the first floor of the White House. And everywhere I walked, I heard people moaning, crying, and weeping. I could see no one. Went from one room into another. Not a person was to be seen. But everywhere, like the roar of a sea, a moan and a cry was going up. I went into the east room. And there in the east room, I saw a coffin. Round about the coffin were soldiers. And I said, 'Who's dead?' And the soldiers answered, 'The President of the United States, he has been assassinated.' That was my dream. And then we come to the scene that we described. The day that he and Mrs. Lincoln were out for a ride. And she said, 'You're very cheerful.' He said, 'This is the happiest day of my life.' It was Good Friday. Good Friday, the day on which our blessed Lord died to save sinners from the slavery of Satan. And she said, 'You remember you felt joyful too, like that the day that Willie died. You seemed to be so joyful in adversity. And on that Good Friday night, the dream came true. And every great character must have a Judas, someone who betrays. And he fell by an assassin's bullet. And the assassin, as he jumped from the box of Lincoln, tripped on the American flag, on which many a tyrant has tripped since, and fell. And Lincoln, who had never openly quite confessed the redemption with his own lips, now confess them, redemption with his own life. For he often said, 'Our concern is not whether God is on our side, but whether we are on his.' George Washington will always be the father of our country. But Abraham Lincoln will always be its savior. By now, and God love you.